even extended family. I didn't say it because I knew that no one was going to take it seriously. Oh yeah, sure. You know, 15, 16 year old Christopher's writing a book. Sure, sure, sure.
You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is Christopher Paolini. A revolutionary quantum teleportation device promises to bring humanity one step closer to the stars until it fails spectacularly. The Translocator from M.G. Herron, available now on audible.com. Go to mgherron.com/ASP. Archaeologist Eliana Fisk is ripped from Earth while the whole world watches. She lands on a strange new world inhabited by a lost tribe of ancient Mayans. Meeting them, getting first-hand exposure to age-old customs and rituals. It seems like an archaeologist's dream. But what if the rituals have a darker meaning? What if the god these people pray to is no god at all? And how in the world will she ever get back home? Thus begins a pulse-pounding race against time that hurls Eliana into a great unknown, revealing ancient technologies and marvelous mysteries more outlandish than she ever imagined. The Translocator is an action-packed sci-fi thriller perfect for fans of Stargate, The Atlantis Gene, and other archaeology-inspired science fiction adventures. Pick it up today. Go to mgherron.com/ASP. That's mgherron.com/ASP. The Translocator by M.G. Herron. Welcome to Author Stories. Find archives of all the shows at HankGarner.com, and while you're there, never miss an episode by subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and YouTube. It's free on all platforms. Out today, Book 3 of the Saga of the Iron Dragon, the conclusion of the epic series that began with the Dream of the Iron Dragon. 9th century Iceland, three explorers from the far future have a daunting mission. To save humanity, they must build a craft capable of reaching the stars. The Voyage of the Iron Dragon is the concluding book in the Iron Dragon trilogy. The Iron Dragon trilogy is being produced as part of the phenomenally successful Saga of the Iron Dragon Kickstarter, which raised over $10,000. Meticulously researched and packed with action, The Dream of the Iron Dragon is a must for sci-fi and alternate history fans. Also, Book 2, The Dawn of the Iron Dragon, is available now from audible.com. There's a link to it in the show notes. Also, thanks to Josh Hayes and Richard Fox for sponsoring the show with their series Terra Nova Chronicles. Books 1 and 2 are out now. Book 3 is coming very soon, and you can get Books 1 and 2 combined on audible.com, narrated by the one and only Luke Daniels. If you're a fan of the Ember War series, this continuation is one that you are going to want to have on your Kindle, in paperback, or in audiobook. Grab it now, Books 1 and 2, and be ready for Book 3. Also, thanks to Rick Partlow for sponsoring the show. With his book Glory Boy, Caleb Mitchell had to give up his home to save it. Shunned by friends and family, abandoned by the love of his life, he left his world to go to the academy and train to fight in a looming war against an implacable alien threat. The fleet turned him into an enhanced super soldier designed to put the fear of God into aliens who think their emperor's God, asked to sacrifice his humanity to protect his people. But when his home world is threatened, will Caleb throw away his career and risk everything to save the people who turned their backs on him? If you're a fan of Starship Troopers or Altered Carbon, jump into the world of future super commandos and star-spanning galactic war with Glory Boy from Rick Partlow. There's links to all of our sponsors in the show notes. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Christopher Paolini back on the show with us. He was here about a year and a half ago, and we talked all about his history as a writer and his phenomenal Aragon series, and we got a little glimpse into what Christopher's been working on since then, and then Christopher kind of slipped out this new project on us about a month or so ago, just a few weeks ago when we were recording this, and so I asked Christopher if he would come back on and talk about it. Welcome back to the show, sir.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm always happy to have you, Christopher. You are one of those people that you have this singular experience that no one else I've ever talked to has had. You know, you wrote this fantasy series that you began when you were like 15 or so and published it, and your experience is like no one other I've ever met. So it's always fascinating to kind of pick your brain.
Well, hopefully some of my experience can help other people who are on the same journey to getting published also. I will say that, you know, when I went through the experience of publishing Aragon and the rest of the books in the Inheritance Cycle, I really didn't realize how unusual of an experience it was at the time. You know, I was 17, 18, 19 when all that was happening. I had no context, you know?
Right.
And the older I've gotten, the more I've sort of looked back on that and go, wow, that actually happened.
Right. I would imagine the more people you meet in the industry and the more up and comers you meet, you really do realize that your experience was not like everyone else's.
That's definitely helped also. Yeah, just context. I mean, that's the thing we all lack when we're young, which is context. And gaining more now has definitely given me greater appreciation for how wonderfully lucky I was and how awesome the readers have been. And also perhaps a greater appreciation for the underlying appeal of Aragon also.
The last time we talked, you said that you were diving into the world of science fiction, which we knew that you have always been a fan of, but you really made, staked your claim in fantasy. How's that project coming?
It's going well. It's funny because I'm kind of having the experience that a lot of writers have before they get their first novel published, where, you know, you write a couple of drafts, you write a couple of books that maybe don't entirely work before you start figuring out a workflow and a system that really works for you. And in my case, I seem to be doing that after the fact. with my sci-fi novel, I finished up the first draft a while ago now and realized I could do a lot more with the characters in the world and the story. So worked on a second draft, and that didn't quite go far enough with the world and the stories. So I, at that point, had to make a big decision about whether or not I wanted to continue to commit time and effort to a story I'd already been wrestling with for a couple of years. And I just hate to give up on any project. So I said, you know what, I'm going to give this one third go through and see if I can do justice to the idea that I've had in my head for so long. And that's been this third draft, which honestly, I should be done in the next month or two. It's actually just going to depend on how much time I spend on the road touring for The Fork, The Witch, and The Worm, the new fantasy novel. But I've been printing out the novel and giving it to my early readers. And so far, the response has been just a huge thumbs up from everyone saying, yeah, you got it this time. So, you know, if anyone's feeling discouraged about their own work or has struggled with, getting it right the first time, I mean, the thing is very few of us ever get it right the first time. I did not get it right the first time. If I'd showed people the first draft of Aragon, no one would have published me. I mean, there was a friggin' unicorn in the first draft of Aragon. That's how bad it was.
Oh, I love that. I love that so much.
And yes, I've gotten into arguments with other fantasy authors about unicorns. I'm not a unicorn fan.
Well, but some people are very passionate about their unicorns.
That's the arguments.
Right. That's a hill some people are willing to die on.
Oh, man. So as someone who is known for his fantasy, in switching genres to science fiction, have you found that people are excited to see what comes, how your mind interprets science fiction? Do you feel like people are giving some pushback? Like, no, he's our Christopher, and he is a fantasy writer. You know how yeah. people can well, be. What's your experience been?
I think it's hard for people to judge it one way or another because they haven't read it. Right. They haven't seen it. And what they know from me is, of course, the world of Aragon. And that, of course, is what the new book is set in. A lot of readers are, of course, excited and looking forward to that. But I think the majority are just sort of withholding judgment and are going to wait and see, which is the reaction I would take if a writer I followed was doing something similar. And I think that's a perfectly fair reaction. But I will say, from my own point of view, if someone has read my work and enjoyed it from the fantasy sort of thing, I think they're going to very much enjoy the science fiction as well. You know, there are very specific things I like in stories, especially stories that I'm going to write. And all of those things are present in this new book. So if you've responded to the stuff in the Aragon, in the Inheritance Cycle, I think you'll respond equally to the science fiction. At least that's the hope.
So
honestly, the biggest difference for me is that it's not the characters. Characters are equally important no matter what genre you're writing. It's not the pacing. It's not the even necessarily the structure of the story. Honestly, the biggest difference for me was getting to use a modern vocabulary, which I really enjoyed after so many years of basically limiting myself to a more era appropriate language with the Inheritance Cycle, and B, finding out that, you know, spaceships and things like that, technology puts certain limitations on what you can write about, in the sense that if you need to get from point A to point B faster in a fantasy novel, you can say that, well, you know, it was a dire emergency, and so you kind of push the horses a little harder, right? You know, or you push yourself harder, and we can expect human flesh and flesh in general to be able to give more when it's an emergency, but you can't expect the same of machines 9 times out of 10. You know, a spaceship, like a car, can ultimately only go so fast. Right. And that ends up putting some pretty hard limits on the logistics of your story, which is not a bad thing, but it is a different thing.
Well, you know, Arthur C. Clarke famously said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. When you're writing future science fiction, with the, I know you just kind of enumerated some of the logistical, you know, differences. But in some ways, is it very similar to writing fantasy, in that you do get to kind of hand wave a little bit and kind of build the reader's imagination with you?
I mean, yes, but as with fantasy, you really have to be internally consistent, and it depends what kind of science fiction you're trying to write. In my case, I'm trying not to contradict physics as we know it, even if I am expanding physics as we know it, and that was a very tricky thing for me to do, and it's a balancing act. But at the same time, you have to realize that unless you're actually writing like a science textbook or something, that the story itself is ultimately going to be what's important to the readers. On the flip side, you don't want to be compromising the structural integrity of the world around the characters so that the reader starts to roll their eyes and saying, well, of course they got out of this scrape. You know, anything's possible because the author just waves his or her hand and gets people out of scrapes based off, you know, some new physics or technology that they didn't tell us about previously. And that's no good. Just like with magic, you don't want to be pulling stuff out of the – changing the basic rules on your last book when facing down with a villain.
Right.
Assuming one is facing down a villain.
Well, usually we are at some point.
That's usually, but not
usually,
always.
You know. Yeah, this is a unique experience that you find yourself in. And when you were writing Aragon and the first book, and no one knew who you were, and no one knew that you were writing a book, and you know, the world didn't care yet that this was going on, that can really be a gift. The kind of solitude and the being unknown can be a gift for a first-time writer because there's no pressure that comes with that. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and in fact, I actually made a conscious decision when I was working on Aragon to not tell people that I was working on it. I mean, my immediate family knew I was writing, of course, but you know, my friends at the time, even extended family, I didn't say it because I knew that no one was going to take it seriously. Oh yeah, sure, you know, 15, 16-year-old Christopher's writing a book. Sure, sure, sure. So it was one of those things where, you know, I withheld that because I needed to actually do it before talking about it. And there's some psychological research that has proven that if you say you're going to do something, a lot of times you can end up sort of getting the psychological benefit of actually doing it just by saying you're going to do it. And that can end up removing the motivation to put in the work to accomplish what you need to accomplish. If you go around saying, oh, I'm going to donate $1,000 to XYZ, or oh, I'm going to write this giant novel, and then you don't actually do it. So I mean, I do like to keep my fans in the loop with what I'm doing, so that they've got some sense of what's going on. But yeah, I think it's more important to just do the thing rather than talk about the thing.
Sure. Well, because now you have lots of writer friends, you've been connected with lots of other writers. You have a certain standing in the community. Do you ever rely on some of these other authors? Like, you know, would you critique a section of the book? Are you kind of holding on to that anonymity again to get the story out?
Well, I would only critique someone else's work if they specifically ask me for it. But as for my own work, yeah, I actually, there are a few people I've shown my stuff to. In fact, in the acknowledgments for the new book, I actually mentioned the author Fran Wild, who's a friend of mine. And she read an earlier version of the third story in that book, the story titled The Worm. And she gave me a couple of very useful comments, actually. So she's mentioned in the acknowledgments as a result.
Nice. So you're in the midst of working on this new project, and Aragon just won't leave you alone, apparently. what is this new project? Where did it come from? And just tell us kind of where we find ourselves in the world of Alagusia.
Well, you know, I just have not been able to stop thinking about the world and the characters since I finished the last book in the series. I think that's probably to be expected given that I worked on the main series from 1998 until 2011 when the last book was published. I mean, that's a big chunk of your life, no matter who you are or how old you are. And as a result, I keep finding myself, like many of the readers, wondering, what are the characters up to? You know, what are they doing? What's happening with XYZ? And oh, wouldn't it be cool if such and such a thing happened? And a number of those thoughts and ideas have popped in my head over the years. And some of them are full-length book ideas. Some of them I've even laid the groundwork for in the main series for a big, massive upcoming book. But I haven't tackled any of them because I've been working on other projects and I did need a break. But about a year and a half ago, 2 years now, I finally reached the point where I really wanted to write something in the world of Alagusia. And so I'd seen a movie that I'm not going to name because you never know who you're going to work with in Hollywood. But I'd seen a movie that wasn't entirely successful. Let's put it that way. And my sister and I had sort of dissected the structure of the film and were discussing, you know, what could have been done instead of what was done. And that prompted me to think about a couple of interesting structural things. And as a result, I sat down and wrote the third story, The Worm. And I'd always wanted to write more about the Urgles. And also I wanted to write about a dragon that was more of like the... And I realize these are some spoilers, so fair warning to everyone. I wanted to write about a dragon that was a destructive force, like the old dragons of myth and legend. All of my dragons up to this point have been, for the most part, a little bit more friendly than is traditional. And so I wanted to do something different. And so then, but then the story itself, was too short to publish. It was also a fun challenge for me to see if I could write a self-contained story without taking a million published words to do it. And that I really enjoyed. So yeah, I had that story and that just sort of sat around until this year when I got sort of a bug in my ear to write another one. And that ended up being the first story in the book. And that story actually started out because of a tweet from a fan. Last year, or no, 2017, the fan tweeted me and said, you know, hey, what's happening? Tell us something about what's happening with the character of Murtagh, who was one of the main characters in the Inheritance Cycle. And I was feeling a little flippant at the time. So I just kind of said, oh, well, you know, he's fighting a bunch of enemies with a magic fork that he named Mr. Stabby. And wouldn't you know it, that just would not get out of my head. So I ended up writing a story that sort of used those elements.
Oh, that's fantastic. It looks like there are about 9 stories in the book. Is that right?
There's 3 main stories, and okay. Then there's a framing device around all of them, which is another story, and that one's about Aragorn and is from his point of view. So it is essentially a lot of smaller stories, but they tie together into a main narrative.
Gotcha. Are all of the stories written by you?
No, the middle story, The Witch, was written by my sister, Angela. And she was the inspiration for the character of Angela the Herbalist that kind of spoofed my sister with that character. And she had a good sense of humor about it. So this time around, she said, you know, hey, I've got an idea for something I'd like to write from the point of view of that character. And what people may not realize is my sister and I have actually been collaborating for a very long time, but most of that's been behind the scenes. So I run all of my... You know, I bounce my story ideas off her. She's usually my first reader. She tends to give me editing when I need it. So we've been working together for a while, but this was the first time it was sort of like an official collaboration. And that was fun. I mean, I think for her, the challenge was coming into a world that was, you know, someone else's world and someone else's character and fitting her voice into my world. But she did a good job. And her voice feels very different than mine while still being appropriate. And that was perfect for the character.
And she writes as Angela the Herbalist in the book, doesn't she?
She does indeed. She does indeed.
So she kind of inhabits that persona that you created for her. And it's kind of a payback to you for doing that.
It is. And it's a very enigmatic, fun little vignette. And Angela's a superb writer in her own right. And I'm very much hoping that readers are going to get to see more of her in the future because she has a really wonderful way with words and language.
That's fantastic. For longtime Aragorn fans and fans of the Inheritance Cycle, what do you think they will enjoy the most about this collection of stories?
Ooh, that's a good question. Well, if you haven't read the cycle, I would say that if you haven't read the cycle, I think you can certainly pick this book up and enjoy it. It's a classic fantasy book. There are dragons, there are battles, there's magic. It's got all the elements you'd be looking for in a fantasy novel. If you have read the previous novels, I think that you're really going to enjoy seeing, you know, old characters, what they're up to, what's going on, and also getting to know some new ones. One of the interesting things for me was to look at the character of Aragorn and kind of ask, you know, what would it be like for a person who did have the experience of being the hero, of being the big hero, of facing up against a great force and overcoming it and, you know, getting plaudits and lauded by everyone, and then needing to find a way to move on with your life after that and find another cause, another purpose to get you up every morning.
Who is the, in your eye, who is the ideal reader for the Inheritance Cycle? Is the series for everyone? Do you envision a certain age group or a certain demographic that you write to?
That's a good question. I just try to write the best books I can. There are certain things I stay away from in the series, because I don't think they would fit with the general, you know, tone or style that I've established. But aside from that, you know, I'm not writing for specifically a 14-year-old, but I'm also not writing for a 40-year-old. I'm just trying to write what seems appropriate for the stories. And I really do have readers of all ages. When I go to the conventions and all of that, I've got, you know, young kids coming up who are getting the book for the first time, and then I've got their parents who are, you know, asking me, when's the next book? When's the next book? And I think also because the first book came out when I was so young and it's been long enough, what's kind of startling to me is that I now have a decent chunk of my readers who have, you know, grown up and started families of their own and are passing the books on to their own children. And that's, you know, that's something that usually happens later in the career for an author. And I'm getting that a little sooner than most, I think. And it's very gratifying, but is definitely a new stage of a writing career for me.
Well, an interesting anecdote. My kids grew up reading your books and reading Harry Potter and a couple of other, you know, fantastic series that were all kind of coming out about the same time. Percy Jackson is one. And my oldest son now is 23 and is teaching English. He teaches middle school English now. And the books that I gave him when he was growing up are now on his bookshelf in his classroom. And he's passing those books down to, you know, to middle school students now. And it's it just makes my heart happy to see that. As you've seen your fan base grow up and then passing those books on to a new generation, how do you still connect with these readers that have grown up? Do you do things to keep connected to your fan base, and do you see your fan base morphing as they age and new readers come in?
Well, I mean, continuing to write books is a good way to keep connecting with your fans. Also, you know, I go to a fair bit of conventions when I've had the chance, at least two or three a year. And that's a lot for me, at least. And that has been a way for me to stay in touch with people, even when I'm not, you know, going on full-blown book tours. I think the most important thing, and this applies to whatever age range you are writing for, and that is to just treat your readers seriously. You know, treat them the way you would want to be treated as a reader and as a person. And people respond to that. I respond to that. And I think that's really what matters. You know, so when you sit down to write, you know, you think about not only what's right for the characters, but also, you know, how is this going to affect my readers? And it's a weird thing because, and we might have talked about this last time, but you know, it's a weird balancing act that you have to do as a creative artist, which is, on one hand, you can't worry about what people are going to say about your work, because if you do that, you'll be paralyzed by fear, indecision, and the fact that you can never actually please everyone. But at the same time, if you completely ignore your audience, you can end up writing things that don't appeal to anyone. And it is a very delicate balancing act. I think, at least for me, the easiest way to deal with that has been to sort of separate the two processes. So, you know, when actually writing, you don't think about anything but your own desires with regard to the story. You know, how do I want this to read? How do I want this to look? How do I want this to feel? But then in the editing process, that's where you think about the audience. You know, how is this actually coming across to the reader? And what can I do to enhance that experience?
Christopher, we talked earlier about the gift of writing in anonymity before anyone knows who you are, and the time that comes with that. What a lot of authors I've talked to kind of express the same sentiment that when you find success, that a lot of times your schedule gets filled up really quickly with things that are not writing, business things that have to be done, and you find that you spend all of your day supporting writing but not actually writing.
I'm kind of struggling with that at the moment because everything's gearing up for this upcoming tour that I'm going to be doing for Fork Witch Worm. I'm going to be touring here in the States at the end of January and then again at the end of February, a week each time. And then probably they're going to send me over to Europe, all of which is fine. You know, it's wonderful to have that opportunity, and it's not something I've done for a little while, and it's going to help support the books, and it's great to meet the fans. But given that I'm right at the end of finishing this draft of the science fiction novel, it's frustrating in the sense that I just really, really want that out of my hair before I go spend, you know, 3-4 weeks on the road. And it's a real balancing act. You know, there's interviews, there are contracts to look at, social media to handle, and all of it chews up time. I'm very fortunate because I have a whole team of people, you know, my family, and I've got I have an assistant, and they do a wonderful job of trying to build a shell around me so that the writing time is protected. But I know a lot of writers who don't have that luxury. And I had a conversation one time with the fantasy sci-fi author Tad Williams, and some of your listeners may be familiar with him.
Yep, he's been on the show.
He's been on the show. Great, great guy. And I remember the few times I've been around him, and he's got a lot going on in his life. And, you know, he has a family, he has pets. And I remember asking him, you know, how do you find time to write? How do you do all of this? And his answer was that he basically is writing in his head throughout the day when he's doing all the other things that he needs to do. And then when he sits down at the computer, it just kind of all, you know, gushes out in one go, and he doesn't have the luxury of, you know, sitting there and feeling precious about the prose or anything else because, you know, there's stuff to get done. And you know, honestly, the older I've gotten, the more I've realized none of us have the time to be feeling precious about our prose. That's not to say that you don't strive for beautiful writing. We should all strive for beautiful writing, but our time on Earth is limited, and you know, if you're not feeling a sense of urgency with your work, then you are not thinking about what's going on.
Absolutely. Speaking of feeling precious, what about your writing space and the tools that you use? Some people need to be in a completely quiet room. Some people need to go to a coffee shop. Some people are very very determined and very set in their ways about how they write, where they write. Do you have any preferences in that way, or can you just, you know, sit down anywhere and keep the story going?
That's a good question. I've written all around the world. Like I finished the first draft of the science fiction novel when I was in Edinburgh and Barcelona. So, I mean, I've written while traveling. For me, I'd say the most important thing is I'm very sound sensitive. So if there's too much noise around me, I just cannot focus. It's too distracting. My body won't relax enough to allow me to ignore my body and sink into the world of the story. I end up getting distracted by sort of my own physical responses to the noises I'm hearing. My sister can write in a coffee shop and be very happy with that. I find it extraordinarily difficult. And oftentimes when I've tried it, I'll end up producing prose that is like a little repetitive because I keep losing my spot and have to keep going back over it and that sort of thing. If it's too quiet, I'll put some music on in the background, but usually pretty softly and only music that doesn't have any words in it and that I'm already familiar with. Other than that, I tend to do my plotting by hand in a notebook. So, and I like a fountain pen for that, but I can use a roller ball. No problem there. And then I do my actual prose writing on the computer just because personally, I feel like I have greater command over the language when I'm working on a computer. It's hard to read handwriting, no matter how good your handwriting is. The only really weird thing I do with my writing is in MS Word, there is an option where you can change the background color of your pages. And I really prefer a really dark blue, almost midnight blue background and white text, which is kind of like what some of the old computers used to do.
Yep. WordStar and WordPerfect.
Exactly. Yeah. And I used to poo-poo it, but then I gave it a shot, and I find it dramatically cuts the eye strain when staring at a computer screen for 6, 7, 8 hours. The only caveat would be that blue light like that can keep you up at night. It disrupts melatonin production. So I have a program, a free program on my computer called Flux, which automatically dims my screen and reduces all of the blue light coming out of it when the sun sets local time. So that helps. And I also like my margins a lot narrower or a lot wider than most people do, because if you use the default setting in MS Word for the text block, you end up with a very wide text block. Go pick up any published book and you'll find that they almost never, ever go wider than 2.5 alphabets worth of letters in a single line. And that's because the human eye just has trouble scanning that long. That's kind of why newspapers will split the text up into columns. And so I find that if I use the default text block setting in MS Word or most word processors, that I end up with paragraphs that are too big for what they're actually going to look like in a published book. And of course, then I don't actually have a good sense for the published length of my work in terms of page count. I have to go entirely off of word count at that point. So what I do is I give myself 2-inch margins instead of 1-inch margins. And it still ends up being a little bit longer in published format, given the way Random House lays out my text, but it's close enough for government work, as they say.
Well, it really is interesting to see your work and see how the formatting is working as you write, because when you look at the page, you can really get a sense of, especially in dialogue, of kind of what the rhythm is just by looking at paragraph length, and that's a great tip.
I mean, formatting is one of those things where, on one hand, you can say it doesn't matter, right? Like you can take text and reformat it for an ebook where none of the paragraphs are indented and you've got double spaces between each paragraph. I've seen books reproduced like that. And if it's a good book, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. I mean, you know, with Cormac McCarthy not using quotation marks and other punctuation marks, he gets away with it, you know, because his writing is gripping and it works in that sense. But that said, I think that there is a meta element to writing, which is the artistic sense of how does the text actually look on the page. You know, if you want to create a sense of tension, you could put a bunch of ellipses and draw the text physically across the page and, you know, put it on multiple lines. In fact, I even did that in the final battle in Aragon at one point to give that sense of almost time slowing down. Things like that are maybe not necessary for a writer, but they're good tools to have in the toolbox. They can definitely become annoying if you use them too often.
Well, I really like the idea of writing in a plain text editor and just getting the words out with no distraction. But every time I've tried that, I always come back to MS Word or Google Docs or some other standard word processor for the exact same reason that you're talking about. We live and work in an age now where we can control those things, and I think it does make a difference. It makes a difference to see how your work is going.
And you're going to have to work in MS Word anyway. Every publisher uses it. You have to learn how to use track changes. Now, I've been using MS Word for a very long time, and it's a lot more flexible than a lot of the other word processors out there. You can customize the toolbars. You can literally customize, you know, what you're going to see in the drop-down menus. You can customize every single key combination there is. And in fact, I've done things like that with track changes. Like, I've got a key combo programmed in where I go command apostrophe, and it will hide the markup completely, but keep the final text. So then I can make all the changes I want with track changes on. I can edit, I can make the changes, and then I don't have to be distracted by all these marks on the page. And then if I need to see the markup, I can do that also. You know, little things like that are, again, not necessary to be a successful author, but they are real quality of life issues when you start dealing with large manuscripts. Another trick I got, and I have to give credit, I got this from Brandon Sanderson, was learning how to use the document map.
Oh, yes.
In MS Word. And for those who don't know, it's basically where if you MS Word has styles, and if you apply those styles to different chunks of your text, like if you have one style that you apply to all of your chapter headings, for example, MS Word will build a map, a document map that'll appear on the left-hand side. You can access along with the search bar and everything else that lets you bounce around inside your own manuscript. You can just click on those headers and it'll bounce you to that point in the manuscript. And you can even do like nested levels. So for example, I'm doing something new in my science fiction novel. I have subchapters within each chapter. And I also have sections. The book's divided into large sections. So sections, chapters, subchapters, and each one of those gets a different style. And as a result, those get, they show up as collapsible lists on the side in the document map. And when your manuscript's well over 200,000 words, that starts becoming extremely useful.
Well, I know a lot of people that use Scrivener, and one of the things that they talk about as being one of the benefits that they appreciate is the ability to go in that left-hand sidebar and grab a scene or a chapter and just drag it to another point in the document. And I actually made a YouTube video of how to do that in Word with the document map, and you can do the same thing. You can, in the document map, grab scenes or chapters or whatever heading you've given it and drag.
Wait, yes. What?
Yes.
What? Because I heard that, but wait. Are you on a Mac or a PC?
PC, but...
I don't think that feature's available on Mac.
Really?
Because that's... Yeah, I... Sanderson told me something similar, and I remember when I did the research on that, I don't think they've implemented that on the Mac.
Well, that is...
I will double check.
Okay, do that.
If you are on a PC, you definitely have that ability to just drag and click and drag chunks of your novel around, which... But that said, I mean, if you're having to, you know, restructure major parts of your novel late in the game, you've probably got other problems going.
Yeah, I've never actually had to use that, but I just did it as a response to, you know, Scrivener's better. But I'll include that in the show notes, and if anyone gets any benefit from it, then great. But
actually, I could have used that with my second book, because I had some whole bunch of different POV shifts, point of view shifts in that book that I had not previously written, and I ended up needing to move a whole bunch of them around during editing for pacing reasons. And that feature would have saved me some time.
Absolutely. Well, Christopher, it's been so much fun talking with you again. I know we could just talk all day, but the new book is The Fork, the Witch, and the Worm, Tales from Allegasia, Volume 1. If people are, God forbid, just learning about you and want to dig into more, you do. I know that you have a fantastic website that you're always engaging with people at. Where can they find you online?
Well, social media. I'm pretty active on Twitter and Instagram, and even have quite a few posts up on Facebook. So at Paolini on Twitter, and the same at Christopher_Paolini on Instagram, that sort of thing. I'm usually posting weird stuff on Twitter, so come join me. And I also post fairly regular updates on the current projects and tour info. And people can also find me on my website, which is paolini.net, and that has all the links and all the information and has deleted scenes from the books and interviews I've done with other authors and cool behind the scenes art. And it's fun stuff. And I should also shameless self-promotion here.
Absolutely.
I should also mention that Barnes & Noble has released a special collector's edition of Aragon to sort of coincide with all of this. And it has just shy of 50 pages of extra material, including all sorts of stuff on the world building, art, deleted scenes from the character Murtagh's point of view, a full color map of the world of Allegasia. A lot of stuff that's basically never seen the light of day before. And that's available in your nearest Barnes & Noble.
You're making the collector in me twitch a little bit.
it's really cool. I mean, I've had a lot of editions of the books over the years, and this one, I put a lot of work into it myself, and especially with the colored map, that sucker is just gorgeous. And I would just, last of all, I would say, you know, with the Fork, the Witch, and the Worm, I hope people do give it a shot, because even though it is a shorter novel for me, it is still a full-size book. In fact, it's longer than the first Narnia book, for example, as a size comparison. And as with all of my work, you know, I poured my heart and my soul into it. And my sister did as well for her section. And I hope people enjoy it. I mean, if you like dragons, give it a shot.
And who doesn't? I would think the dragons are represented more than the unicorn people. But we'll see. We'll see. But Christopher, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for taking time to come back on the show. You're one of the nicest guys in the business, and thank you for being so generous with your time.
Well, thank you. My pleasure, and I hope I get to see a whole bunch of your listeners out on the road while I'm touring.
Absolutely. I'll include tour dates and links to the website and Barnes & Noble and all of that good stuff in the show notes at hankgarner.com. Thanks, Christopher. Have a great day.
My pleasure. You too.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane series.
You took a terrible risk tonight.
Why?
You don't know? The first rule.
I was told by a friend that I shouldn't reveal my gift to anyone who doesn't have a gift themselves.
That's exactly right.
Because everyone we tell dies.
Yes. You might have marked me for death.
Made you a target for a ghost. Why can't people know what we can do? What makes it so dangerous? Valerie took up the fireplace prongs and stabbed the logs.
It's called the Great Curse.
Sparks exploded from glowing crevices and drizzled upwards, ricocheting off the black belly of the cauldron, turning into tiny ashes that disappeared up the chimney.
It was cast by a powerful witch over 300 years ago.
Witch? Sorry, but witch? Please, there's no such thing. Valerie closed her eyes. A spoon leapt from Jason's dish and caught him in the temple. He wiped melted ice cream from his cheek. You were saying?
She cast the curse to stop the witch trials.
In Salem? Jason searched his memory. 1690...
1692. They burned her alive in the Salem Common. The only witch to be burned.
The cauldron smoked slightly. Its contents had evaporated. A sharp, charred scent filled the room. Wait, said Jason. There were no witches. They were just, I don't know, victims of religious hysteria, right? So you're saying the witch trials were justified?
Justified? So if a witch did exist, it would be okay to kill her?
No, I just thought... You're right, never mind.
There was one witch in Salem, at least. A woman with a powerful gift. She only wanted to protect people like us. To give the gifted their anonymity, refuge. She cast the Great Curse as she burned. She proclaimed that mortals who know a witch shall know death. And that is the Great Curse. And it's still in effect after all this time.
Mortal, as in?
Non-gifted. No mortal can know about you, about any authentic witch.
Jason winced. Isn't there another word besides that? She shrugged. So no one can know what I am, what I can do, or else they become a target.
Right. The spirit world will obey the Great Curse and try to kill them.
The spirit world.
The other realm.
Jason rubbed his eyes. How much of this was reality and how much of this was Valerie's nutty brand of mysticism? He felt himself pulling back, as usual, for fear of contagion. He'd spent his whole life reading science fiction. He hated paranormal tales. This was not his genre.